We're going to be probing into an absolutely fascinating story. One of many fascinating stories that came in the wake of the fall of the Soviet Union and the destruction of the wall in Berlin, and a turbulent time when the divide between East and West seemed to dissolve overnight. And into that vacuum, if you will, flowed all kinds of new and energetic forces that radically reshaped many people's lives and their ways of looking at the world. Certainly that was true in Russia. And one of the things that happened was an influx of new possibilities in terms of Western music in Russia and Russian music perhaps being shared with the outside world in a way that had not ever been the case before. One person who was at the heart of all of that in so many exciting ways was David Junk. And as the head of an important record company in Moscow during this turbulent time, he was at the heart of many of these most significant efforts to make a lot of money and to nurture all kinds of success stories. But it was also incredibly dangerous work, and he was navigating very, very unfamiliar waters. And he tells all of this so vividly in a new memoir called Rockin' the Kremlin, My Incredible True Story of Gangsters, Oligarchs, and Pop Stars in Putin's Russia. It is a really, really remarkable book published by Roman and Littlefield, co-written with Fred Bronson. And I'm very excited indeed to have David Junk with me to talk about this incredibly interesting book. David Junk, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I really appreciate you inviting me on, and thank you for that wonderful introduction to the book. That warms my heart to hear you say those words.
It's a really, really great book. One of the things that you talk about at one point in your book, and I think it's really important to say this right off the bat, is something to the effect that you're probably the single least likely person to ever run off to live in Russia, especially at such a turbulent time in that country's history. Tell our listeners about where you were born, where you grew up, and the way in which your life then took such a dramatic turn.
Perfect. I'll start with where I started. I'm a Midwesterner too, like you. I was born and raised on a family farm in central Ohio, and I went to school, high school, during the late 1970s and into the early 80s, and this was a time when mutual assured destruction was our way of survival in America. As you recall, we had thousands of Soviet missiles, ICBMs, nuclear weapons aimed directly at us, and we aimed them back at the Soviets. And in Ohio, we had an Air Force base called Wright-Patterson, very famous one. I think it's one of the most important Air Force bases we have in the U.S. And it was very important during the Cold War, too. And it was for sure a target for a Soviet first strike. We always knew that if the Soviets were to start a nuclear war and try to surprise us, Wright-Patterson was a definite target. So because of that, it's something we grew up with. We practiced running to the fallout shelters. We listened to all the different ways we're supposed to try to survive a nuclear war. But you know, we kids were not stupid. This was the end. We knew it, and they even had a TV show on called The Day After. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, vividly.
We were scared as a country, and I was scared as an Ohioan, you know, literally growing up next to an Air Force base that I knew was a target. So that's the context of how I grew up and grew up to fear the Russians. And then when I went to college, I went to a small private liberal arts college called Wittenberg in Springfield, Ohio. And one of my classmates, I studied in the Chinese department. I decided to study Chinese languages, and this is 1983. And one of my classmates was flying over the Sea of Japan in Korean Airlines Jet 007 on her way to classes to study in China back then. And the Soviets shot that plane down over the Sea of Japan. They claimed it was a spy plane. It was a passenger jet. But she perished along with 260 other passengers in that jet, and it sank in the bottom of the Sea of Japan. So I had, and then Ronald Reagan had given his evil empire speech. So it was a very tense time between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during those years, and it stayed that way. Despite efforts to try to lower the tension, it just didn't work. And so fast forward to 1990, and the Berlin Wall comes down unexpectedly. And then 1991, the Soviet Union collapses. And Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika and glasnost has paved the way for Boris Yeltsin and democracy, and most importantly, an embrace of the West, in particular, an embrace of America. So Americans were in demand over there. If you had business know-how or any sort of ability to help the Russians transition from communism to capitalism, and I saw that as a great opportunity. I was super excited about, freedom ringing out in Eastern Europe. I had gone over there to see the Berlin Wall when it was half up, half down. So I met some Eastern Europeans, young Eastern Europeans who were very excited about this new freedom they were gaining. And so I decided to get a business degree and study Russian, because Russian was the language everybody spoke over there, whether they liked it or not. That was the common language in Eastern Europe and throughout the Soviet Union. It was mandatory in the schools.
Right, and
so
you knew that would.
I studied Russian,
and you knew that would be kind of a ticket to perhaps accessing some opportunities over there. One of the best stories you tell in your book is about Pink Floyd going to Berlin.
Yes.
to perform a concert after the wall comes down, and you were bound and determined to go there, and you tell a lot of stories about lining up 2 hours early to try to buy a ticket, and you did get a ticket. You do get to Berlin, and after the concert you kind of lose your way in this throng of humanity, and then you tell us about this completely chance encounter with these two university students from then Czechoslovakia. And that was really, in a sense, life-changing.
Absolutely.
And you knew this was a part of the world where you absolutely needed to live. Tell us briefly about your first couple of seized opportunities to work in this part of the world. They were opportunities that ultimately did not lead to anything particularly positive, although at least they were a foot in the door.
They were a foot in the door, but they were almost a foot in a Siberian prison camp. It really was touch and go. I had all this energy and all this desire to work in Russia, and this is 1994 we're talking about now, and I sent my resume to Moscow, where there were American firms working, and one of them was an accounting firm. I had studied accounting, so accounting was a natural connection, and a firm called KPMG, it's a big six accounting firm in Moscow. received my resume by fax. That was a unique experience, sending a fax then, because I had never done that before. And they immediately turned around and forwarded my resume back to San Francisco, where I was studying, and I was interviewed the next day by that accounting firm, and they hired me to work for their new client, which was a Russian diamond company. And it was a joint venture with some Americans, and it was celebrated in San Francisco by the mayor, by Hillary Clinton, Al Gore. They all appeared in photos with the owners of this new joint venture. It was a really, really big public relations event. And it turned out to be an entire, as they say in Russia, Potemkin village. It was a completely made-up company that was an effort to steal diamonds from the Russian treasury. And it was supported at the highest levels of the Russian government. The prime minister, Chernomyrdin at the time, even had signed off on opening this company. So it was a bad company set up for, you know, for good reasons, this new American-Russian, you know, future, but it was a total sham company. They hired me. They hired a bunch of Americans, actually, to put in the company to make it feel like a real joint venture, but secretly they were stealing the diamonds. Mm. And eventually it all came due, and the FBI closed it down, and it was a disaster. But I somehow survived, and they realized I didn't steal the diamonds. I wasn't any part of that, so right. I got let off the hook. But it was touch and go for
and,
a while.
And you tell us that it took a couple of years before your name was entirely cleared. You go on to describe, as you are searching for another job, that you're offered a job by Heinz, the folks who make ketchup.
Yes.
Not the sexiest of possibilities, but at least it was
no.
a job. But then you saw an ad the very next day for an opening with the record company PolyGram. And explain what PolyGram was anxious to do at that point in time in Russia.
So PolyGram at the time was the largest record company in the world. There were six, and they were the largest by far. They were Dutch-based, but you know their artists. It's everyone from Bon Jovi and Elton John to Bob Marley and Pavarotti. I mean, it really was one of the most important record labels in the world. And they were the first major record label to open in Eastern Europe, and in particular in Russia. And if you recall, back then there was a song by the rock band The Scorpions called Winds of Change, Wind of Change. And that was, they were on PolyGram. They were an artist on PolyGram. And that was such a successful song, and it really inspired so many people to look to Russia to for the future, that PolyGram decided, you know, we're going to be the first to open a record company there. So they did, and they ran into trouble. It's tough doing business in Russia. It's really, really tough, especially then. It was the 1990s. It was the wild, wild east, you know, Al Capone-style business going on there. They called it gangster capitalism is what it was. But PolyGram needed help, and they placed an ad in an English newspaper that's published in Russia called the Moscow Times in the classified section. And I read it all the time, because that's where I found the Heinz ketchup job. I was looking for anything. And then one morning, as I'm trying to decide, do I go work for a ketchup company or not? It just doesn't feel right, but, you know, it's something. It's definitely a job. And suddenly I see this classified ad, help wanted. We need a financial controller or accountant who can speak English. And I said, that's me. I can do that. And then I saw the name of the company, PolyGram. Like, oh, my God, this is a record company. And sure enough, they hired me right on the spot, because I was really one of the few Americans in Russia at the time who could speak Russian or had any kind of a business degree. So I got hired really quickly by them. And that was my entry into the record industry. There's no way I could have gotten into the record industry from here in America. I mean, I had no connections, no family. I didn't even study music. But over there, because of my, you know, being at the right place at the right time with the skills they needed, I get the dream job of my life.
You learned very early on about one of the harshest realities in Russia for anybody who wanted to make money selling legitimate recordings, and that was piracy, rampant piracy, that you tell us at this point in the book controlled 95% of the market. I assume what you're essentially saying there is 95% of any of the music recordings that people were purchasing were actually pirates. I mean, illegitimate copies of recordings with absolutely nothing paid to the artists who had created it, and so on. As you're talking about piracy and how it was just sort of part of the culture, you learned a little bit about that from your father-in-law, the father of the woman whom you had married not too long before. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Natalie was her name, right?
Exactly.
But you tell a story that I found a little bit confusing about how he talked about in his younger days, how he had engaged in piracy, he and his friends, involving x-rays. I've never heard of anything like this. Explain what he was doing and in a sense what it said about kind of the overall culture of Russia at this point in time when it came to something like piracy.
So in the Soviet Union, I wouldn't even label it piracy. I would label it bootlegging, even, because they weren't even allowed to possess this music, let alone pirate it, steal it. You know, they weren't allowed to have Beatles records or Rolling Stones records. So they were set up, you know, this is how it would work. Someone would get lucky and get a business trip to Western Europe, because it was very rare for people in the Soviet Union to be allowed to travel. My father-in-law was not allowed to travel because he was a nuclear physicist, so he was very restricted in what he could do. But friends of his would travel to Western Europe occasionally, and of course they would stop by a record store and bring home a record, bring back to Moscow a vinyl, and sneak it in past the customs officers and everything. And what they would do is they would have like a party, a house party, and they would invite friends over very quietly, very secretly, and they would take the original Beatles album and they would record it. they would transfer it to an x-ray, an actual x-ray that they would have stolen or borrowed or whatever, acquired from a hospital. And they would, he talked about going into the trash dumpster. You could pick out old x-rays and bring them home. And you can record on those x-rays. You can record the songs from the Beatles album onto the x-rays. And he would have a collection of these. They did this over a number of years. So when my wife, as a young girl, was going through her father's album collection, it was actually a collection of various x-rays. And one of them, she noticed, it was clearly signs of tuberculosis. So she could actually spot that on the x-ray that was also playing, you know, Hey Jude and other Beatles songs. And that's how they did it. That's how they really spread bootleg records secretly around, is copying it from the original Western album that they snuck in.
Right. And you discovered very quickly that PolyGram was essentially losing $1 million a year. And it also became evident to you before too long that you had been hired by PolyGram not to rescue their Russian office, but actually to shut it down. and one of your bosses in particular, who was Czech-born, really hated Russia, had deep animosity towards Russia, and she was especially anxious for this to occur, and the decision ultimately is made, and she comes to Moscow and to sort of help at a distance, at an arm's distance, to kind of coordinate the shutting down of that operation in Moscow. Tell our listeners what happens when the two of you are in a hotel and a commercial comes on the television set.
Yes, it was heartbreaking that when I really figured out that I'm not here to have a long career in the music industry. I'm here to help my bosses and PolyGram close this thing down. That was a shocking revelation because I thought this was the greatest job in the world, and I had dreams of a long future in the music business. But they led by this Czechoslovakian woman. They were very worried about their business in Russia. They were concerned about the 95% piracy levels, and they didn't trust the Russian partner they had, a guy named Boris Zosimov. And so they were looking for ways to close it, and that was my mission, though I did not know it. Fortunately, there was other people in the organization that were trying to stop it from closing, the folks that, you know, wanted to expand into Eastern Europe, but the accounting folks led by Jana were in charge at this point. And she, you know, obviously, she grew up in Czechoslovakia. She was there in Prague when the Russians invaded, when the tanks came rolling in 1968. And she never got over that, as most Czechs. Never forgot, never forgave. And it was, you know, kind of difficult for me because at that time, you know, we're trying to come together with Russia. We're trying to put the Soviet Union behind us. And I'm looking towards the future, but I am working with people who have a very, you know, dark memory of the Soviet Union and were not as eager or optimistic about the future. Turns out they probably were right. The Eastern Europeans have always understood the Russians far better than the Americans or Western Europeans, that's for sure. So she comes to Moscow to help close down the company. I'm trying to slow it down any way I can, but it's impossible. This is moving towards closing. And when we're in her hotel room, going through the list of what we have to do, we have to close this, we have to talk to this government agency, we have to, you know, all the different steps to closing a company properly. Suddenly, a news segment comes on the TV on CNN, the business scene in business, and the big news of the day is the smallest of all the record labels in the world, Universal Music, based in California, is buying the largest record label in the world, PolyGram. And sure enough, they did. So the sixth largest record label became the largest record label, and Universal merged with PolyGram, and that saved my job because Universal had a different outlook on the Russian market than PolyGram. Universal was ready to give it another chance and go forward with it. And that saved my job. And I frankly think that saved the Russian record industry, because if PolyGram had left, no one would have been around to discover those artists or fight piracy, and it would have been a disaster. But Universal came in and saved the day.
Mm. We're speaking with David Junk. He is the author of a memoir called Rockin' the Kremlin, My Incredible True Story of Gangsters, Oligarchs, and Pop Stars in Putin's Russia. By this point in time, David Junk has moved from PolyGram to Universal. And this changes everything. One of the things you mention about this drastic difference is that before, when you were working for PolyGram, PolyGram was being run by people from Philips Electronics. And so in your words, now I was reporting, that is now with Universal, I was reporting to executives who perhaps were also songwriters, we were no longer being managed by a company that manufactured refrigerators. In other words, this was suddenly a scenario in which it was much more about the music. One thing that was an interesting tug of war early on was what your boss's priorities were in terms of the artists they wanted sort of pushed, elevated in Russia, that is artists from the West, versus what the typical Russian young person was really interested in. Tell our listeners about this tug of war and, in a sense, who finally won out.
So at the time that I became CEO of Universal Music, one of my jobs was to promote the roster of Universal and Polygram, now the merged company, all of those artists. And these are some of the greatest artists in music, and it's a wide range. But my European bosses in particular wanted me to focus on their music because they believed that was what the Russian kids were going to devour. They really thought that Russians wanted Britpop and some German pop and some French, but mainly some of the big British pop stars that were coming out at the time, like Sophie Ellis Bextor and Boyzone, Ronan Keating, a lot of boy bands, a lot of British boy bands. And the Russian kids wanted nothing to do with that. They were hungry for American music. They were hungry for American pop culture in general. And this whole situation coincided with the rise of hip-hop on the West Coast in America, particularly through the record label Interscope Records and Death Row Records. So I'm talking about artists like Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, 50 Cent, but most importantly was Eminem. Eminem was the breakthrough that really shocked the world, but in particular was a major breakthrough in Russia for hip-hop music. And I wanted, as an American, and as the only American in Universal at that point over there in Europe or in Russia, anywhere outside of America, I was the only American executive. I wanted to promote American music in Russia. I believed in it. It was patriotic, but it was also what the Russian kids wanted. It was just so much more interesting at that time. And that's what I had to push for.
Explain what you did. You received this album, I mean, completely unmarked. I mean, it was like in a plain sleeve. This was sent to you from America, and it turns out to be an album by Eminem. Explain, in a sense, your tactics, what you did with this album to help sort of get it out there, and by doing so, in effect, opening the floodgates for American hip-hop to emerge in Russia. Explain what the first thing you ended up doing with this music by Eminem.
So I'm sitting in my record company office, and a package arrives from California. And this was regular. We would regularly get music from all over the world. Universal, our partners in America, Japan, Europe, England, were always sending us music. And with that music, we were supposed to promote it, put it on the radio, or put it on TV if it's a video. And we would receive this in unmarked packages to evade the pirates, because the great worry is maybe the postman delivering the music is going to secretly flip it to a music pirate, and the next thing you know, your brand new album is on sale everywhere in the country, counterfeited. So it was a security issue to keep it unmarked and protected. And when I received this package from California, it was in a white white cover, white CD, and I knew nothing about it, nothing about what kind of music it is, what genre, the name of the artist, nothing, just completely blank. And I was told to hold on to this and not to do anything with it until I'm instructed otherwise. Well, it turns out when we played it, it was Eminem's masterpiece, the Marshall Mathers LP. It would go on to become one of the biggest selling albums of all time, one of the biggest selling hip hop albums of all time. And at that point, there was a lot of doubters. You know, Eminem was white. A lot of people were talking about Vanilla Ice, you know, as the last great white rapper. Not great, really. But there was skepticism. everywhere. The fact that he was produced by Dr. Dre made a difference for sure, but it was still doubted heavily by my bosses in Europe. They just didn't believe some white rapper would be a big deal in Europe or Russia. But I did. I knew it. I knew this was a breakthrough. I knew this album was going to catch fire and be the biggest thing in the world. I could just feel it. And so with my very clever marketing staff, we decided to violate the rules, and I did that often. I would get in trouble all the time with my bosses, but it always worked out in the end. But I violated the rules, and we gave the album to our employee who's in charge of putting music on the radio. His name was Sasha, and his job was to take new music to all the radio stations and get them to play whatever, the new Bon Jovi song, the new Elton John song, whatever it is. And he took this blank, this white CD without any information on it, who it is, and he dropped it off to one of the radio stations and said, listen, I'm not here. You didn't see me, but check this out. Next thing you know, that song is on the radio, and they're playing it nonstop. And soon enough, MTV is demanding a music video. And by that point, it was too late. The kids were wanting to hear more of this album, this rapper, and my European bosses couldn't stop it at this point. Eminem became the biggest star in Russia at that point.
As you're talking about this, you say something really intriguing. You said, we weren't just selling music. We were selling a lifestyle. What exactly do you mean by that? What lifestyle was being sold?
Hip-hop is much more than music. It brings people together unlike any music I've ever seen, and one of the things that I got to witness firsthand is how American hip-hop imported into Russia helped create a homegrown hip-hop industry of Russia's own hip-hop artists, rap artists, and fans gathering around and combining into a very tight community like that. And hip-hop is all about authenticity, so you can't fake it. And the kids really love authenticity. And that's why it just took off. And the next thing you know, we've got we have this very large hip hop community that was growing and growing, and pop music and rock music was starting to become less and less important. It was all about hip hop, and it went to clothing, to poetry. I mean, it's all kinds of different things involved in hip hop beyond music. It's all, and like I said, it's all about authenticity, and that is what really the kids found attractive. America produced the best hip hop in the world, and so it was just in demand, and it was devoured by the Russians.
Ultimately, you felt like your highest calling was not to bring somebody like Eminem, his music, into Russia, but to nurture Russian artists and share their music with the wider world. What was behind that desire? And I ask that in part because that desire represented something that actually turned out to be really tough, really challenging, maybe more so than you even realized at the outset. But what was behind that hunger that you had to steer your career in that direction?
Honestly, survival. It really was, Greg. It was survival because we weren't able to make enough money selling music in Russia. Even selling Bon Jovi to Russians or Elton John to Russians, we weren't making enough money for Universal to keep the company going. It's just because of the piracy. If 9 out of every 10 CDs out there is counterfeit, you just can't develop a legitimate business. And so it became obvious to me that I need to find Russian artists, find them to Universal and sell them outside of Russia, in Europe, Asia, and the dream, of course, of all dreams, America, right? That's the biggest dream for every artist, international artist, hit it in America. It's also the dream for every record executive who signs an artist internationally to hit it in America. So I knew I had to find an artist that could compete successfully on the international stage. And this is a time when we've got some of, you know, we've got Christina Aguilera, we've got Britney Spears, we've got, you know, all these bands and artists and pop stars dominating the charts around the world. And I had to compete with that. And I had to find something unique that would. So I was driven to find the kind of Russian artist that I could export. And that's what really motivated me. One more thing about that, though, I also wanted to be, at this point, a real record executive. I didn't want to be just a guy selling Eminem albums in Russia. I wanted to be like some of my heroes, like Clive Davis or David Geffen, some of these really famous record executives who developed the careers of, you know, Whitney Houston and Bruce Springsteen. You know, I mean, that was at this point really what I was hoping for. So I wanted to find artists myself, sign them, develop them, and watch their careers grow, just like Clive Davis had done. And that really also inspired me. But the main thing was survival. I had to do this to survive over there.
In your search for such a Russian pop star, you end up hearing an amazing song via MTV by a young 15-year-old girl. The song is Winter Dream, and you realize this singer has the potential to be exactly what you were looking for. What you did not learn until later was that her father was one of the most powerful and one of the most dangerous oligarchs in Russia. What an amazing shock that must have been when you sort of realized who you were dealing with in terms of this young girl's father.
It was shocking, but it didn't deter me. And I think it would have deterred a lot of people. But I was so driven to find the pop star that would become the first Russian pop star to sell records in America. That was, it really was driving me. And so when I learned, and I only learned very late in the process, literally after the contracts were already drawn up and we were handling logistics for the press conference where we were going to invite this young pop star. Her name was Al Su. We were going to have a press conference to announce it to the world, because this was historical. It was the very first time a foreign record label had offered a Russian artist a recording contract like this. So it was history making, and we did have a big press conference to celebrate it. But I only met her father at the press conference, and he had to sign the contract because she was 15. So that's when I learned to expect one of the most powerful, dangerous men in the country to be showing up to sign a contract with me for recording his daughter. And it was unnerving for sure, but I think I was a little naive about the danger. I knew his company. It was well known. It was called Lukoil. It was the largest oil company in the country, and they produced billions and billions of dollars of oil for the Russian government. So he was a very wealthy man and a very well connected to the Kremlin. And my staff, my young Russian marketing staff, who obviously knew a lot more about how dangerous this was, tried to advise me maybe I should have second thoughts on this. But I kept going. I kept on going, and I thought, well, you know, I can get along with anybody. I can get along with a super powerful, dangerous Russian oligarch. I'll find a way. You know? and I knew what he wanted was his daughter to become an international pop star, and that's what I wanted. So that became that's what brought us together. Despite the danger, that's what motivated me, and that's what he wanted me to do.
Right. What's really interesting, and you take us through kind of this and that, kind of the ups and downs, and at the end, you finally kind of spell out Alsu was talented, but not desperate for stardom. She wasn't as hungry as some starving artists who had nothing else going on and no other options for a career. And so that's probably one of the reasons why, in your words, the bright future I planned for Alsu never happened. But you scored a tremendous success with a duo, two young ladies known the world over as Tattoo, Julia Volkova and Lena Katina. We don't have a lot of time, but I want you to at least briefly explain the way in which their success was like a tidal wave, in your words, like Russia's version of Beatlemania.
Exactly what it was. So I saw their video before I heard their song. I saw their video on MTV late one night. It was two schoolgirls in the pouring rain on the one side of the fence, the community, their parents, their teachers on the other side of the fence, and these girls embrace and a kiss. And it's a very rebellious kiss, and it was not meant as something sexy or fascinating like that. It was meant as rebellion, as really provoking the community. And at the time, the Soviet Union has a history of being anti-LGBTQ. That, homosexuality was illegal during the Soviet Union. It was still very much looked down on in the modern Russia, those early years. And all of a sudden, there's a kiss, two girls kissing on Russian TV nationwide. And this sent a shockwave through the country. And I signed them to Universal Music because I believed not so much in the shock value. I believed in the song. The song was a hit. It was a bona fide hit song. And my radio promoter, who I always relied on for every decision, said, "This is a hit, David," and that's all I needed to hear. So I signed Tattoo to Universal, and they became the biggest selling band in the history of the country. And to this day, they're still the biggest selling Russian artist in the history of the music industry. And it was, yes, in large part due to the shock value of the video, but in my mind, it was really due to the fantastic songs that they had produced and a really masterpiece album that was embraced from Brazil to Japan to Iceland to Australia and most importantly in America, which is what I always wanted, and that's really how they became the Beatles of Russia.
And you tell great story after great story about them, including when you are meeting with somebody from this company called Interscope that ends up backing them and helping to kind of facilitate this this move into America, you're asked the very basic question, can these two girls sing in English? And without having any idea if they could or not, you said, yes, you were not going to let this door slam shut. And ultimately, of course, all of that was worked out, and they do achieve tremendous success in so many different ways. You do, however, tell us that in the wake of recent events, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, these two young women who once upon a time boldly spoke out against unnecessary war have, in your words, been cowered into silence. This speaks to the reality that Russia is a very different place now than it was when you lived there. In our last couple of minutes, be curious to have your reflection on how drastically things have changed, and and your hopes for the future?
Well, tattoo is the perfect metaphor for that. They sang, they appeared on the Jay Leno show, The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, in 2003, and everyone expected the big controversy to be them kissing. They didn't. They didn't show that on TV. What they did show was what the girls wrote on their T-shirts, which was foul language, you know, F the war, written in Russian. And this really upset the FCC, and they were banned from Jay Leno for this. But it really was an anti-war statement. The U.S. had invaded Iraq for the second time, and things were not going so well at this point, and the world was turning against the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And Julian Lennon decided to make a statement on American TV about it, which I always thought was one of the bravest anti-war statements ever made on network TV since the Vietnam War. But fast forward to 2022 and the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and Julia and Lena are silent, as are almost all the artists I worked with during those years. And they are fearful for their careers and for their livelihood, and perhaps even imprisonment. They're starting to arrest now artists and musicians. So that's one of the great tragedies for me, is that I had worked so hard to build bridges between Russia and the U.S. and promoted bands around the world. But when this war broke out, all those bridges have just been washed away, and all the efforts I've done have been for naught, because the Universal is closed. They're no longer doing business. The record industry over there is still going, but it's not the record industry I'd helped build. And it's really so unfortunate that Putin has done this to their country. He has ruined the reputation of one of the great cultural countries in the world, producing some of the most important culture in the history of the world, and Putin has really ruined that reputation, and that's what's, you know, one of the many things that's very disappointing about this war in Ukraine is the long-term effects this will have on Russian culture, and rightly so.
It is certainly damage that may be to some extent irreparable. But nonetheless, you can look back with great pride on what you accomplished and your legacy there. And you tell that story remarkably well in this book. Again, the book is Rockin' the Kremlin, My Incredible True Story of Gangsters, Oligarchs, and Pop Stars in Putin's Russia, published by Roman and Littlefield. And the author, David Junk. David Junk, we only scratched the surface of all the great stories you tell in this amazing book, but I'm glad we could at least do this much. I appreciate you being so generous with your time, and certainly wish you well. Thank you again for being my guest on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It was a real pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
It's coming up on 9 o'clock. Wisconsin Today from Wisconsin Public Radio is next. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.